books that are authored by me. One is Divorce and Remarriage in the Church, which is what I'm saying, but without my speeded up talking, and you can read it at your leisure. And it, the reason it reads so nicely it is because it's not written by me. That is, I wrote all the words, but not necessarily in this order. Someone edited it so well that it's rather like digesting chocolate. It's great. Yeah. Some of you know me through writing in Christianity magazine, where every month I have to come up with something startling and new, which is difficult if you don't want to be a heretic. But and I've written this book, The Jesus Scandals, which picks out all the unusual things about Jesus' life, all the things where the gospel writers are saying seemingly bad things about Jesus, you know, like he goes and meets with prostitutes and he drinks a lot and goes to parties and he's killed as a criminal and all these bad things about Jesus, because these are things which they wouldn't say, would they, unless they had to, unless they were true. And so it's a great way of giving your non-Christian friend an interesting book, which they think is going to be a sequel to Dan Brown. It's actually going to teach them about the historicity of Jesus. And they're all short chapters, one coffee cup only chapter. So it's very good. I hear the prices for these are $9.99 and $7.99, but she says if you buy the both, you get them for £15. That sounds like quite a good bargain to me. Yeah, especially as that they're reprinting this at the moment, and she got the last copies. So even the publisher has run out of copies, but our bookstall here hasn't. In the States, I think it's in its ninth reprinting, but they have more problems with marriage in the States. Now, we're coming to the end, in the sense that now we can abbreviate, we can understand the abbreviation of the Jesus' response and his passage in the New Testament, and also we can deal with remarriage, and then I want to listen to you. Let me just sum up where we were before. Why did Christians think that Jesus rejected divorce for neglect and abuse? Because they misunderstood that phrase, except for sexual immorality, which we all misunderstood. The church quickly forgot the legal terminology behind it. They didn't understand it. It rather like someone in 100 years might misunderstand the question, may a 16-year-old drink? Because they forget to add on the phrase, because it's drinking alcoholic beverages. They forget that this is a particular form of divorce that Jesus is being asked about, the any cause divorce, and Jesus rejected that form of divorce completely. And he said that Deuteronomy was only talking about sexual immorality, adultery. But of course, Jesus was also allowing divorce for the other texts in Exodus 21, which everyone accepted. Now, a lot of what we would want Jesus to say, and probably a lot of what Jesus did say on that day, is not in our text. If you read through the longest account of this debate with the Pharisees on that day in Matthew, the longest account will take you about 30 seconds. And I guess they were talking for longer than that. After all, they were theologians. It's abbreviated because papyrus is expensive and our time is limited. So we have to look at that abbreviated account and look very hard at it. It's even worse in the beginning of Matthew, Matthew 5, and in Luke 16, where the whole thing is summarized into one sentence. It's like the headline account. Everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. Now, this is rather like the headline. I was trying to think. You know, headlines in a newspaper, they grab your attention, but in a misleading way. You know, man destroys rock band. And then when you read the account, it's because he chipped the quartz band out of this rock. Headlines are there to grab your attention, and when you've read it, so you can remember easily what it was about. This headline, everyone who divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery, is correct, it's accurate, but you have to understand what's behind it. Virtually everyone who was divorced in Jesus' day had this any cause divorce. And what he said was, I reject any cause divorce. It is not biblical. You have to have proper grounds for a divorce. And if you've got divorce for any cause, you're not properly married. Because you weren't divorced properly in the first place. You're still married to your old partner. You never had a proper divorce. So if you think you've married someone else, you're not married to someone else. You're actually committing adultery. Because an any cause divorce isn't a divorce at all. You have to have a divorce for a ground. And the only ground in Deuteronomy 24 is adultery. And of course, we have the other grounds, which we agree on, of abuse and neglect and abandonment. But just the headline is misleading, though it's correct, because everyone he's talking to, if they've divorced, they've got an any cause divorce, and he says, well, that divorce is invalid. So if you've remarried in the meantime, you're just committing adultery. He's got their attention. He's got our attention. And it's a headline which is correct, but you have to understand the details behind it. So a Jew in the first century, of course, would have got this in a couple of seconds. It's taken us an hour, but we've got it now. We've got it. Enid, there's a plus here. There's the next thing here. Matthew added the phrase, except for immorality, which I think you haven't got on yours. So Matthew added that phrase, except for immorality, as a helpful reminder to the people who were at that time. Because his readers would remember the Jewish debate. It was now finished, the debate had been over, but his readers would remember it. They would remember how Hillel found those two grounds, whereas others said it only refers to immorality. And the helpful addition introduces a lot of confusion for later readers. Because when the debate was long forgotten, Matthew's version gained a new meaning. So anyone who's divorced and remarried except for immorality is committing adultery. It now sounds as if it means the only ground for divorce is immorality. And that's how the church interpreted it in the second century onwards. So let's do the work that those first readers would have done in their heads very easily, very quickly, inserting phrases to understand what's going on. Matthew does this to start with. In his account, he takes Mark's account and he inserts some phrases to help the later reader. So you have the opening questions. The Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife? And Matthew says to himself, my readers are not going to get this because they've forgotten about that. They've forgotten what it's all about. So he adds, for any cause, just to remind them what they were talking about. Is it lawful to divorce your wife for any cause? And then he answered, he who created them from the beginning has made them male and female. Oh, some of my readers aren't going to realize he's quoting scripture there. So he says, have you not read that he who created them from the beginning made them male and female? Therefore, a man will leave his mother and father, and so, etc. And then further down, when the Pharisees bring him back to the question, he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, it was, but not from the beginning, it was not so. He reminds them, hang on, it's because Moses allowed you to divorce. It's not a matter of compulsion. He's answering this thing, but didn't Moses command you? So Matthew's helping the reader again. So I'm pointing this out. Oh, and of course, the most important one is right at the end there. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. That's the headline phrase that you find in Luke and in the beginning of Matthew. Except for sexual immorality. That's Shemite phrase, just to help the reader again. Now, I'm pointing that out to show you that Matthew is adding those phrases to help the reader understand, because I'm going to do the same thing now and add even more phrases. You have it on your handout, the sort of longer version, unpacking this abbreviated account. This seems like a strange thing for you to do, because you don't normally add phrases into something you've got, because now we're used to writing in a way that is plain and you don't need to add anything. But I'm very used to this sort of thing because I'm working with rabbinic texts all the time. The rabbis abbreviated what they had to the barest minimum because they memorized everything. They didn't write things down. They had everything in their brains. And so you had to have the briefest summary of what the teacher said and memorize that. And then in your mind, you expand it again into the full teaching that the teacher had. So they're really good at abbreviating. And when you read these things, and when you translate them, you have to put so many things in square brackets, and you're doing that knowing what the context is, knowing what the teaching is, and being able to expand in that way. So I'm very used to adding things in square brackets. You actually are also used to doing that, but you do it mentally, and you don't realize you're doing it, you know, as in can a 16-year-old drink. So we're going to do it very consciously here and add in those phrases. So what are we going to want to tell a 21st century reader? First of all, they want to know the context. They want to know the context that we're debating that the meaning of that phrase in Deuteronomy 24:1. They want to know what that phrase is, that evat davar, that what it means, this cause of immorality. They want to know what the Pharisees' objection is, that they believed in this compulsory divorce for adultery. They need to know this Old Testament allusion to hardness of heart, because most readers, when they read it, they don't realize it's an Old Testament word. They also need to know the Old Testament grounds for divorce, the broken marriage vows. It's very basic, but it's easily forgotten. So when we look at this passage, let's add what we already know now. So the Pharisees came up to him and tested him by asking, is it lawful to divorce one's wife using Deuteronomy 24:1, where the Hillelites found the any cause divorce? We know that now, but we need to tell ourselves, remind ourselves. Then you have that digression on marriage elsewhere, not in just in Deuteronomy 24:1, but marriage everywhere. Jesus is answering about marriage in general, and we've underlined the verses that he's quoted there in case you forget where they come from. And then for what God has joined together, let not man separate. And we now know how you actually separate in a divorce. It's by breaking those marriage vows. So let not man separate by breaking his marriage vows. Jesus is telling every married person, you must not break those marriage vows, because that can lead to divorce. But they drag him back to the subject of divorce. They say to him, well, why then did Moses command one in Deuteronomy 24:1? They're dragging him back to Deuteronomy 24, because that's what they want to talk about, to give a certificate of divorce if she broke her marriage vows and to send her away. And he said to them, because of your hardness of heart, and we now know what that means, that's refusing to repent of your repeatedly broken vows, as Israel in Jeremiah 4. Moses allowed you to divorce. And then right at the end, I say to you, whoever divorces wife using any ground in Deuteronomy 24, except for sexual immorality. Because that's the whole point. There's only one ground in Deuteronomy 24. You can't have any cause. It's not there. It's an invention of the Hillelites. And if you're relying on anything else in Deuteronomy 24, you don't have a divorce. And if you marry another, you're committing adultery because the divorce is invalid. And now with those additions, you've got something that makes plain sense immediately. But those additions are all in the head of the first century reader, and they're not in our heads. That's the difficulty. Oh dear, well, wouldn't it be easy if we had more papyrus in the first place? So now we can read Jesus' final statement like a first century Jew would have heard it. He's saying the only ground of a divorce in Deuteronomy 24 is sexual immorality, because the verse is the whole context of that debate about what any cause is. Now, as a nice result of this, finally, Paul and Jesus are friends again. They agree with each other. They don't contradict each other. They're both saying God got it right in the first place. The law that God gave to Moses for Israel, to humans, is the same law that applies to humans now. You should remain married, but sometimes things go wrong, and when it's not your fault, you can decide whether to forgive or whether you've reached the end. So when Paul, and it's amazing that we ever thought that Paul and Jesus might be not in agreement, because this is the only place where Paul actually quotes Jesus. In 1 Corinthians 7, to the married I give this charge, no, not I, but the Lord, that the wife should not separate from her husband, but if she does, she should remain unmarried or be reconciled to her husband, and the husband should not divorce his wife. If the wife walks out and there's no good grounds, she should not go and get remarried. She should try and be reconciled. You need to have good biblical grounds for a divorce, And Paul is telling that woman, go back, and certainly don't get married, because that means it's you can't be reconciled. But she has to be reconciled, because she's done something wrong against her husband here by abandoning him, and it's up to him whether to receive her back or to say, no, that's abandonment. You've done it so many times. Really, this marriage is not working anymore. Paul, like Jesus, utterly rejects no-fault divorce. That's divorce without any grounds. And of course, Jesus rejected the Jewish no-fault divorce, the any-cause divorce, and Paul rejects the Roman no-fault divorce. Now, the Roman no-fault divorce was a divorce by separation. They said, as soon as a wife walks out, or as soon as a husband kicks a wife out, the divorce has happened. You don't need paperwork, you don't need lawyers, you don't need a public statement. As soon as that separation has happened with you being divorced, you are divorced. It's complete, immediate. So Paul faced a problem in Corinth that we face. A woman walks out, and that effectively produces a secular divorce, because after a few years, the law says, okay, the marriage is over. Presumably, she didn't have any grounds, because there's no significant fact mentioned. And Paul says she should attempt reconciliation. So he's answering the situation using both the teaching of Jesus and the teaching of the Old Testament that Jesus' teaching is based on. Jesus rejecting the no-fault divorce, Paul rejecting the no-fault divorce. Now, I get lots of emails from people. Let me give you a few situations I often face. People have been divorced without biblical grounds, like that woman in 1 Corinthians, and they want to remarry. Or people who have been divorced against their will, like this man, and they want to remarry. Or they've remarried after a wrongful divorce. They recognize the divorce wasn't really biblical. They've remarried, and they wonder whether, to put it right, they should divorce again and attempt to get remarried to their first partner. Okay, let me leave those three with you for a little while. You pick one and think about what the answer should be. One situation that perhaps you know about. People who are divorced without any biblical grounds and they want to remarry, or that they've been divorced against their will and they want to remarry, or they've been remarried wrongfully and they think they should break up that second marriage in order to try and re-establish a first one. What would you say? You're thinking. Hey, oh. Certainly, yes. If your partner walks out on you, in 3 years' time, they can file for a divorce and you can't contest it. Yeah. I think it's less than 3 years now. Yeah. Yes. You can treat it as abandonment. But that's being divorced against your will. Now, let me go through these three principles that I normally use to deal with them. First one, I've just heard from here. What did you say?
Try reconciliation.
No, the two wrongs.
Two wrongs don't make a right.
Two wrongs don't make a right. Yeah, it's a lovely glib phrase, but there's a lot going for it. Two wrongs don't make a right. If you've gone into a second marriage wrongly, well, breaking up that marriage in order to try and put right the first wrong you did, that's trying to make two wrongs into a right. It doesn't work. It's like stealing from someone else to repay money that you owe them. Two wrongs don't make a right. You're just breaking a new set of marriage vows in order to try and undo the broken set of marriage vows. Two wrongs don't make a right. It's a nice little aphorism which actually works in this case. The second principle, as I have, is if you're a victim of divorce, try to forgive and attempt reconciliation. But the role of a pastor in that situation is always to try and encourage them to mend the marriage. If you're a pastor or if you're a Christian friend, your role is always to try and attempt to help them mend that marriage. But if it falls apart in the end, then your role changes. Then your role changes to become one of support. It's only the person inside that marriage who can really know whether forgiveness is still possible. You can always encourage people to forgive and forgive and forgive, but in the end, the person inside that marriage, the person behind that front door of respectability, only they know what's really going on inside that marriage, and only they know when it's past the point of no return. And the third principle is, if you haven't remarried after this sort of messy divorce, don't, while reconciliation is still possible. Paul doesn't actually say that you can remarry eventually after a wrongful divorce. He just gives that command, don't remarry. But I think we can assume that if the other partner doesn't want to reconcile, well, okay, then the remarriage is possible. You're told not to remarry so that reconciliation remains possible. But if your first partner just rejects that attempt at reconciliation, then there's no reason for that anymore. But remarriage is a big problem in the New Testament, mainly because the New Testament says so little about it. We have three indications that perhaps remarriage is wrong, but none of those actually stand properly. They're sort of proof texts which fall down when you look at their context. First of all, you have this teaching of Jesus that if you remarry, you commit adultery. But now we understand that. He's saying, well, all you people, you've all remarried on the any cause divorce, and that's not a real divorce. You're not actually divorced. Jesus is telling them you should have grounds for your divorce. Secondly, marriage is called one flesh. And certainly in some traditions, that's regarded as meaning it's got an ontological status. That is, once you're married, you're always married. There's a heavenly bureaucracy which says that you're married, and there's no way forward from that. But one flesh is also used in different ways. One flesh is used for a union with a prostitute. You become one flesh with a prostitute in 1 Corinthians 1. And there would be virtually no non-Christian, Roman who became a Christian who hadn't been with a prostitute. That's the sort of society it was, unfortunately. And Paul would have had to say, well, you're already one flesh with these different 50 different women. There's no way you can marry. And if one flesh meant once you've had a sexual union, that is your union for life and eternity, then no Roman convert could ever marry. And Paul doesn't say that. So I can't see that one flesh means that. And the other one is that marriage is described as ending with death. In Romans 7 and in 1 Corinthians 7, it says that a marriage comes to an end with death. And it doesn't say a marriage comes to an end with death and divorce, or death or divorce. Divorce isn't mentioned. Now, equally, it doesn't say marriage comes to an end by death, but not by divorce. Divorce just isn't mentioned. And when you look at the context of those two in Romans 7 and 1 Corinthians 7, it's quite clear why divorce just isn't mentioned. It's not mentioned as being allowed, it's not mentioned as not being allowed, because the first one is talking about the Jews were married to the law, and in order to become married to Christ, it says you have to die. But of course, you can't die, so Christ dies in your place. It's a nice picture of how Jews transferred from the subjugation to the law, subjugation to Christ. It's a nice picture. But of course, the law isn't to commit adultery, because the law is law-abiding. And the law isn't going to cause a divorce, because the law is law-abiding. So divorce just doesn't come into that picture. There's no reason to mention divorce. And in 1 Corinthians 7, again, divorce is completely outside the context, because the context there is widows. Widows' marriages don't end with divorce. Widows' marriages clearly end with death. That's the nature of widowhood. So So there are good reasons why divorce wasn't mentioned in those places, and to try and put it in, try and insert it and say marriage ends with death but not divorce, there's no way you can insert that phrase in there. It just doesn't work at all in the context. So that those three ideas of saying the New Testament teaches against marriage, they don't work. But equally, the New Testament doesn't say that you can remarry. The New Testament is so silent about it. There's only one place where the New Testament might say that you can remarry. That's 1 Corinthians 7:15. If an unbelieving partner separates, let it be so. In such cases, the brother or sister is not enslaved. We often translate it not bound, but it's a word of slavery. The Lord has called you to peace. And it's a very difficult verse for us to grab hold of, partly because that's slavery language, partly because that God has called you to peace, and partly because of the context. And, oh, dear, should I go through all this? Probably not. Jewish legal terminology, your divorce certificate is called a certificate of emancipation, because the divorce certificate says you are now free to marry any man you wish, and it's very similar to the wording of an emancipation certificate from slavery. They didn't mean that when you're married you're enslaved. You're not a slave to the kitchen sink or whatever. It's because of the legal similarity between the divorce certificate and the emancipation certificate. So you have this slavery language which is built into Judaism for marriage. Paul is saying here, your unbelieving partner has left you. I'm telling believing partners who leave without any grounds for divorce, they have to return, but your unbelieving partner isn't listening to me. What can you do? Well, in those circumstances, you've been abandoned, there's no way they're going to come back, and in that situation, you are not enslaved. You are no longer enslaved, and the Lord has called you to peace. It's not you're still bound to that marriage, because the marriage ended as soon as your partner walked out with view to being divorced. That's Roman law. It's you're not bound to not remarry. You are free. But it's so vague, it's so empty. The New Testament is so empty of law about remarriage, it's difficult. Until you look at the context where they were. For a Roman citizen who was divorced, and even for a Roman citizen who was widowed, it was illegal to stay single. If you were divorced, you have to remarry within 12 months. If you're widowed, you have to remarry within 18 months. This was a law enacted by Augustus in 18 BC and still carried on throughout the first century. It's because there were so many Roman citizens who didn't want anything to do with this hassle of being married and bringing up children and having to deal with a wife and having to have a house. And then they just tried to escape their responsibilities. And it was rather like Europe, you know, where our population is shrinking, so we need more workforce from outside to build up our population again. All of European populations are shrinking like Roman ones was, because they just didn't want the hassle. Fewer people were getting married and fewer people were having children. And so Augustus introduced this law that once you are divorced, you have to get remarried, and that there are financial benefits for having children to try and build up the citizenship again. If a Christian decided, I'm divorced now, I'm not going to get remarried, and they were a Roman citizen, their neighbor could take them to court and take half of all they possess if they won the case. Christians could be terribly persecuted if they didn't get remarried if they were Roman citizens. Now, it's not just Roman citizens. If you were a Jew and you were divorced, or if you were a Jew and you were widowed, you were expected to get remarried unless you already had two children. Now, the rabbis debated over exactly how many children. One of them said, well, maybe just one child, but no, it says benim, so it must be two children. And then they said, well, if it says benim, which means sons, so you have to have at least two sons But another one said, no, 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 Benim can be used for a son and a daughter. So if you have at least one son and you have a daughter, that would be okay. And one said, well, no, no, because Moses had two sons before he gave up having another wife. And then the other one says, ah, but God only had one son and one daughter. And God trumps Moses. You can see the way in which these rabbis debate things. But the point is, if you didn't have two children, you had to get remarried. It was impious not to. So this is the situation that Christians found themselves in. If they were divorced and they didn't have the children, or if they were Roman citizens, they were divorced for anything at all, and it doesn't matter how many children they had to get remarried. Now, Paul could have said, I'm sorry, but Jesus says we must not get remarried and we must just face that persecution and we must face, like we face all sorts of persecutions. But he didn't. Jesus could have said, look, I know that the Jewish tradition says that we should get remarried after we're divorced, but you must not, because divorce for anything, for biblical grounds, is wrong. But he didn't. The silence there is very, very significant. We would have been willing to face that persecution as Christians, but we are not asked to. So suddenly the silence in the New Testament on remarriage takes on a completely different meaning when you understand the context that they are in. I'm sorry this is so hurried. I'm afraid you're going to be forced to buy this book. And seeing as you're buying one, you might as well buy the two. You keep the one on divorce and read it, and you have a glance through the Jesus scandals and you give it to a non-Christian. I remember the plumber at Tyndale House said, hey, this would be great for my daughter. He's not a Christian, she's not a Christian, but he said, this is fun. Yeah, so give it away. Let me just recommend Plema Bible. Plema Bible is... Plema Bible. Move on. Yeah. Oh, well, divorceremarriage.com. That's the place where you get links to everything. You can read the whole of that book, actually, for free on there. But then you don't have a copy to show your pastor. But Plema Bible. Plema Bible is a nice, fun way of getting all these facts. It's actually put together by someone from New Zealand. He took that photograph in front of the actual Tyndale House door. That's me on Plema Bible. I look much more handsome there. I also have a dog on Plema Bible. Lovely. He came from New Zealand to put this together and to put together some videos as well, which you can see on the website, because the subject's so important for him. He had a school friend who married a violent man, and she wanted to divorce him. But her church said that divorce is only for adultery, and this man hasn't committed adultery. You have to return to him. So she returned obediently, and one day, in a violent outburst, he shot her. And my friend was so concerned about this that the churches were teaching only part of what Jesus taught and got it so wrong that he wanted to try and publicize my work in a less academic way. So he's put together a Plema Bible where you can see lots of little Plema Bible characters talking to each other, and there's Jesus talking to Moses and my dog as well. Jesus knows about the sinfulness of humanity better than most. He faced it. He died for it. And he didn't repeal the sensible laws that God gave to Israel, which allowed divorce from abusive spouses. He allows divorce for the innocent partner, but only the innocent partner has the right to decide there's divorce. Paul agreed with that. Jesus agreed with it. But the church soon misunderstood the legal terminology. But every academic commentary since 1850 has pointed out this link with the Hillelite and Shammite debate. We all know about it, except it hasn't quite got through to the church yet. And the church has regrettably been very slow to follow the findings of scholarship. And that's what I hope now you understand. Thank you. Do you want to chair the questions?
First question, right at the back.
And whoever put gin in here, thank you very much.
Not turned on as I am now, thank you. I'm sorry. Thank you for that. This is really actually a question, just something on the sheet, just to clarify. On the second side, on the second page, at the top, it says here, hang on. Just want to get the words right so that if I look at it afterwards, I can understand. Under the Shammai, the first century lawyer, the Shammai, it says, nothing except immorality.
Yep.
But then further down, Jesus says, no, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality.
Yeah. The
is that just a...
Unfortunately, the Hebrew is very vague. Evat divar, evat is a word which means nakedness, basically. And divar is a word or a thing. So it's a thing of nakedness. When it was translated into Greek, the similarly vague term was chosen, porneia. Porneia means anything in sexual immorality. Yes, it's sexual immorality, but it's abbreviated in different ways in different places.
Okay, so they're both sexual immorality.
They're both sexual immorality.
Because I think immorality is another word you were saying too, like drink.
Immorality, people immediately think of sex. Evar is a very wide-ranging word, and so is porneia, but they are sexual immorality. Yes.
Okay, because I think immorality and morality themselves need exploring, don't they, in some of these contexts.
And I should have put sexual immorality there.
Okay, yes. Cheers, thank you.
Yeah. I'm just coming to terms with this idea that you had to remarry legally if you were a Roman citizen.
Yeah, we're not Roman citizens, fortunately.
No, but it just brought up questions about where was Paul in all of this, and Jesus wasn't married, and you know, I know there's some chapters in your book about the ineligible bachelor, but how did these, you know, I get the impression Paul wasn't married.
Yeah.
Have been married, but he wasn't married.
Paul is almost certainly either a divorcee or a widow.
Yes, but a widower. How did he get away with it?
Because, there was a rabbi, Simeon Benazi. He also did not remarry after his either divorce or widowhood. We don't know what he was. But he said, I'm married to Torah. My wife is Torah. My wife is the Bible. And I'm so busy with her that I don't have time to get remarried. And somehow he got away with that. And I guess there were many Jews who did that. But Paul also, he was kind of a bit, outside Judaism anyway. I'm sure that many people would have seen him as being impious. And of course, we don't know how many children he had or if he had children. We know nothing about his family, really. So, maybe he had two sons somewhere and that was fine. But he doesn't seem to have been picked out as being strange for not being married. So we assume that something like that happened. With Jesus, he was picked out for being unmarried. And, it is very clear that he had a stigma about this, about his remarriage. And as you say, in Jesus scandals, it says there about why he wasn't marriageable at all. No one would give his daughter to marry Jesus. And I won't spoil the fun by telling you why.
I think as well, when we look at Paul, it's important to look at the context that Paul was speaking in, and he was very sure that the second coming of Christ was going to be in his lifetime, and there are other passages where he actually encourages people to remain celibate or to not marry. So that, just for the last person, that might help.
In 1 Corinthians 7, where virtually all the teaching about marriage and divorce is all put nicely into one chapter, which is fortunate for us, he says, if you are single, don't remarry because of the current crisis. And we're not told what that current crisis is, but we know from the history books that there was a 10-year period just around about then when there were a lot of famines, and there was one year in particular where there was a terrible, terrible famine. And of course, you don't bring children into a time of famine. Being married in an age when contraception is not very secure. They knew about contraception, but it didn't always work. You get married, you have children, and suddenly you can't look after them. So Paul was very keen on singleness. Not celibacy. If you were married, he demands that you don't deprive your partner. But he was very keen on singleness, and he was proud to be single now and be able to serve the Lord without distraction. Yes, so he says a married person has many anxieties.
My question was on the law thing as well. What happened if you were outside childbearing age and you were widowed?
Then you were allowed to stay a widow. The church, of course, has this special function for looking after widows, but Paul says to young widows, go and remarry. He actually says that in Timothy. Young widows shouldn't just gad about gossiping. They should go and get married and manage a household. Yeah. But of course, women don't do that anymore. They don't gossip anymore.